I read it from a reputable green team site. This is from the CelticsBlog.com, right, Murray?
Correct.
Okay. Bobby Manning wrote this the other day, and it was just a survey of the players that came out of the third lottery position. Not the third pick, but the teams that started with the third lottery position and what happened. He said,
This is Cousin Anthony. Welcome to the Bobcast.
I'm going to bomb this.
So that's where I got it from, Dave, just by the way.
Everybody out there, and welcome back to the Bobcast. We're back. It's been a while since I've all talked to you on this platform, and I was just wondering how we could bring back the program, do something meaningful for this marathon journey I'm on, trying to get going in the Boston Marathon this year. I'm in. We're all signed up. We're ready to go. Trying as hard as I can to get in the shape I need to be for that, which seems unattainable at times, but trying the best I can to get there. So today, we'll see how this goes. I don't really know how this interview is going to go, but it's something I felt necessary to do since all of you have been so graciously donating to this cause, allowing me to run the marathon as I've always wanted to do, but better yet, get some money to this Beth Israel Cancer Center that I know does a great job, did a fantastic job keeping my dad in good spirits, keeping him under great care for a whole year back in Boston during my freshman year here at Syracuse. So I entrusted someone who I respect deeply today to flip the script on this. I'm not going to be doing the interviewing today as I have on the past couple dozen episodes with the Bobcast. I'm flipping the script. I'm going to be the interviewee today, and I'm allowing a very special person to me, Sam Fortier, to take the hold. This guy was my sports editor in the fall. I knew him a little bit my freshman year. He was out in L.A. doing his thing with the Ringer and stuff like that, so he wasn't on campus as much, but I got to know him a little bit better this year. I respect his work big time. He's written for a number of different places, including the Daily Orange, and he helped us all grow a lot in the spring, and better yet, been a good friend to mine since I've gotten here. So giving him the mic right now, letting him take control, and we'll see where this goes. This is going to be the story of me, my dad, and the whole journey we've been going on the last year and a half or so.
I appreciate you saying that, Bobby. I'm here really to serve the function as a listener. I don't know too in-depth about your dad's story and your story, so I'm kind of here to be the listener, to be those people that have been donating, to kind of figure out a little bit more and take us inside the process. So why don't you start us out with, when did you first hear about the diagnosis, and kind of take us through, you know, that process and the timeline here?
Yeah, so the beginning of this story is really weird. Most people come to college pumped up, ready to go, especially here at Syracuse. Like, people are going out like the first three nights, people are fired up. And I was expecting that feeling. Like, I was always so fired up about coming here. I was like buying all the Syracuse stuff I could get. And like, my thing around city back home, Peabody, was that, like, I was a Syracuse guy. Like, I was more gung-ho about going to my college than anyone else. I was wearing the stuff every day. And so coming here, it's a five-hour drive, six-hour drive from Boston. We took my dad's truck up. It's a long, long drive, fading in and out of sleep, stuff like that. Feeling a little bit nervous the closer I got to Syracuse. And We've all felt those nerves a little bit, but they seem to hit me extra hard going up there, because I'd never really been away from home at that point. Like, I hadn't gone on any big trips for a long period of time. And so the closer we got to Syracuse, the more nervous it made me. And we finally were drawing up to Mount Olympus here. So you're going up this hill, we're waiting in a big line to unpack all our stuff. And it was really weird. The closer and closer we got, the more we went up the hill, the more nervous I started to feel. And so, like, with every step, taking stuff out of the car, like, it just grew. And we go up the elevator, bring everything into the room, it grew. And then the second my parents left the room, they were going to be in the city for another day, but when they left, it just hit me. I was like, whew, this is a lot. Because I just want to accomplish so much here. that first day where it was like, all right, now this is all on me. My parents are gone. I got to meet all these new people. I got to do this and this and this. It all hit me at once. And so the first day I was here, you got Graham Dining Hall up there on the Mount. And I go downstairs because I was going to meet Paul Schwedelson, who you know well, who is a former sports editor at the DL, because I was going to, you know, get going right away with the volleyball beat that fall. And I'm going downstairs to meet him, and we link up, and we're sitting down eating a meal, and I just start, like, breaking down in the tears, and, like, he seemed, like, all weirded out. He's like, what's going on? And, the emotion hit me that first week I was there really hard, just being away from home, being separated from my parents, and not knowing anyone here for the most part. I had one person coming from my city who I knew, which was huge, because that night I met up with him, and I was like, wow, this is a lot. But that first week, first day, was a really emotional time for me. And then from there, started meeting some more people. My roommate was great, and I knew him coming in. So that initially started to put this thing in my mind, like, all right, this is going to be a lot different than I thought it was going to be, coming here and trying to accomplish what I wanted to.
So your parents helped move you in. What are your parents' names?
So my mom's name is Patricia. And my dad's name is Robert as well. He named me Robert, so I'm Robert Jr. A lot of people call him Bob back when he was alive. He was Bobby growing up, so then I eventually became Bobby. He called me Bubba growing up. Like, there was just a lot of names being tossed back and forth, but we were both Robert Manning.
So when you moved into college, did you know he had cancer?
No.
What kind of cancer did he have?
AML, which is a rare cancer, acute myeloid leukemia, which is a cancer of the blood, of course, and it's a very deadly cancer if you don't catch it. It can kill you in 1 to 2 months, maybe even a shorter, a little longer time than that. But luckily for him, he caught it early. So the time that I knew he was diagnosed with it, it was scary, it was uncertain, it had like an effect on me that I didn't really know how to handle emotionally. But at that very moment when I first found out that he was diagnosed with it, like, I never imagined that he'd actually die as he ended up doing, which is still weird to think about to this day because it was such a deadly disease. Maybe I was just being hopeful back then and optimistic, as you have to be, but it never hit my mind until, like, when we found out that what was going to happen in the very end, that he was going to die. And that probably helped me get through it a lot, that hopefulness, but it does really ring home how deadly that disease is and how important it is that we get more research and all of that care, everything else that people with that disease need, even though it is rare.
When did you find out that he was diagnosed?
So it was 3 weeks in. I was just starting to get comfortable at that point. I was doing the volleyball beat, and I had met a bunch of good friends at this point. It really felt like I was starting to settle in, not make it a home here. There was this big thing going on with me, like, you know, what is home? I was doing all this deep thinking and just being a little over-emotional at that point, probably. But I was finally starting to feel comfortable here, and I was coming home from a volleyball game that day, had just written a good story about it, was starting to feel settled in that sense, too. And so I'm coming up the elevator, going all the way back up to my room where it all started, and walking toward the door, I got that phone call, and I'll never forget the feeling because I was feeling so good walking toward that door. And then I get inside, and I think my family knew at that point that he had cancer for a week or so, a couple days, and they didn't want to drop that on me because they knew I was having a tough time. But I walked inside the door, and at that point they had to tell me that he was in the hospital at Beth Israel, and he had been diagnosed with AML. I guess after they went back from here, he just wasn't feeling well. He had a bloody nose, I believe. Just a lot of weird bleeding occurrences. I remember the last dinner we had in Peabody before we left. He had cut his face.
How did he cut his face?
Shaving. So he shaved every day. It was something me and him went back and forth about. I was like, why don't you ever grow a beard? And he just never wanted anything to do with a beard. And so he shaved every day. Sometimes he'd get these cuts on his face that he'd, you know, cover up with a little tissue or something, and it'd be fine. But we were going to this restaurant, and he had cut his face shaving, and he kept trying to cover it up and, you know, do the thing with the tissue, but it wouldn't stop. and he kept going and going. And it's really weird to think about now because he was yelling at me. He was like, "Do you use my razor?" I was like, "No." And we were going back and forth this whole dinner about this, and it's so weird to think about now. Like, he thought, like, I used his razor and, like, screwed it up or something, and it cut him extra bad. But what was actually going on is, you know, something weird with his blood in association with the disease that was starting to develop that we'd find out about 2 or 3 weeks later.
How did your family tell you?
It was my mom over the phone. I don't remember exactly how it went, but I think she pretty much just dropped it on me. And at that very moment, I was sitting at my desk in my room, and my roommate, Dan Scott, who I had become very good friends with at that point, was sitting on the other side of the room, and we were just sitting there, and I heard the news. She dropped it on me that he had cancer, and I just remember, like, not knowing how to react. Like, you know, there's so much going on inside your head at that point, so much uncertainty, so much fear. So much disbelief. Like, I never in my wildest dreams would have imagined that even though cancer touches so many people, that it would touch me that directly. And I pretty much just dropped my head and stopped thinking and just cried at that moment. And my mom had hung up the phone at that point. It was a short conversation. I talked to him. He told me everything's going to be all right. And I just didn't know what to do. I just put my head down and started crying. I turned to Dan and told him. I was like, "My dad has cancer." And he was like, "Holy crap." And we just sat there in silence for a few seconds. And at that point, he was just like, "Anything you need, I'm here for you." And that was the moment. Like, that was where everything changed that first year for me.
Right. And so you had, like, pretty unfamiliar circumstances and definitely a lot of emotions. And how long was it between when you found out and when he ended up dying?
It was that whole first year. It was a wild journey. It made that first year that can be challenging in college in general, and obviously was for me with all the emotion I was feeling going there. It just made it hard at every single turn. And I was trying to do so much. You know, I cover the Celtics. I do these podcasts. I was trying to break in at the DO. And so, in a way, trying to do all those different things and do school and this and that helped take my mind off it, and being here so distant from the situation helped me take my mind off it. But at the same time, it just made everything, all the challenges of that first year, forming good relationship with friends, with you know, teachers and people at the DO and all that, it just made everything so much harder, because at every turn, like, I was just dealing with all this mental angst and not knowing how to handle it. And so these normal situations that are hard to begin with were just made that much harder. And, you know, I had to try to reach out to people and talk to them about it and try to understand it and what it meant for me. And I had trouble doing that. You know, people would say, "I'm here for you if you need to talk." And it's just tricky, because no matter what, you do feel like you're burdening someone if you're just putting your sadness, you're breaking down in tears in front of them. There was a lot of that first year. And luckily, family members that those first few weeks after were calling me nonstop. I was always calling my dad, and I just end up breaking down on the phone here, there, breaking down in private. Like, you just had to break down just to relieve yourself of all the stress that was weighing on my mind at that time.
And when did your dad eventually die?
He passed away in May of that year. So I had just finished up finals. He had been put back into the hospital. There was really a span of events through this year that everyone has to understand to know the story well, because he was battling cancer through the fall. I had went home a number of times just to be with him, and it was really weird. I'd probably went home 2 or 3 times during the fall semester, maybe more. And every time you got to take this journey into Boston, go into this hospital room, put on masks and stuff since you're getting your blood cells beat down by the chemo or whatever the treatment was, so his immune system was obviously broken down. And so you'd have to put that in all these masks, you'd have to be in a hotel room with, not a hotel room, a hospital room with him. And there'd just be like the separation factor, like, we're not at home, we're in a hospital room, we're wearing all this gear. And it was tough, not only that, but the fact that each and every time I went home through the fall, you know, he was a bigger guy, 6 feet, big belly, and So he big arms. He was a bigger guy, and to see him like shrink, lose weight, look weaker and weaker every time. Obviously, your hair falls out from the treatment. That was tough visually for me. And the second or third time I went home, he had like these dark circles around his eyes. His hair was gone. He was skinny, which I had never seen in my life. And I went home and walked up the stairs, and it was a surprise. We walked up to my room, and we opened the door, and it was like a surprise to me that he was there. So my mom was getting all excited about the fact that he was home. And for me, you know, it was cool to see him home, but opening that door like that second or third time I'd been home, just to see the physical condition he was in at that point, probably a month or two in the treatment, was really tough for me, because that's when it became real. Like, this is changing him. This is like hurting his body badly, and this is like breaking him down, not only physically, but eventually emotionally it became tough for him as well. So through that period, was getting chemo, all of that. He got a bone marrow transplant from his sister. That was a big deal early on. They were trying to find someone who could be a match with him blood-wise, and luckily two of his family members were. He comes from a family of 5, 6, 7 people, so they tested all his brothers and sisters, and his sister Susan was a match for him. And so they got the that transplant done. His numbers started coming back a bit blood cell-wise. The cancer was gone, so by spring break, it had gone in such a good direction. He was coming home at that point. His blood levels were back to normal. It felt like things were recovering. And it seemed like at that time, everything was going to be fine. All spring break, he was home. We still had to take precautions at home, to be all sanitary and stuff like that, wear a mask. But it was going in such a good direction at that point that it seemed like everything was going to be all right. So I go back to school for the second half of spring semester. I'm starting to feel really good at this point. I, unloaded the DO off my back at that point just because I need to unload a little bit of stress off myself. So I quit that, which I didn't feel good about, but I was just feeling good at the amount of stress I was handling, his condition starting to go in the right direction at home. He was going back to the hospital for periods, and at that point, it just seemed like everything was going to be all right, but I heard he got admitted back to the hospital. It was no big deal. They were just trying to, manage his levels at that point. But what was really going on behind the scenes, and I had made so many emotional phone calls at that point that they were just trying to reassure me, but what was really going on was that the transplant didn't work as they hoped. Cancer was starting to creep back in. And so I'm sitting in that new house hallway where you're looking out over the campus. You can see all of the campus, feeling pretty good. It was the last week of real classes in May, and he had been back in the hospital at this point. And the whole time throughout that first year, I always wanted to be home. I wanted to quit school and get back home, maybe transfer back home. But all throughout it, my mom and dad just kept reassuring me, stay there, this is what you wanted, this was what you were gung-ho about the whole senior year. So I just stuck with their advice and stuck it out here. I went home a bunch of times, even though they didn't really want me to, because it was hard to go home and then come back here after. And for the first time ever, I was sitting in that hallway looking out, feeling good about finals being here, getting back home, and she called me and was like, Bobby, you gotta come home. And I was like, damn, I just couldn't believe it. Like, I was like, I can't come home. I gotta do finals this week, and like, everything's gonna be all right. And she was like, for someone who had been telling me it was gonna be all right the whole time, for her to say, like, you gotta come home and put everything aside and be there with them for the last week or so, that hit me harder than anything else. Like, we had come so far as a family. We had seen him recover. We had seen him come home. I, did well in school, got to write some stories, do everything I wanted to out here, meet a bunch of friends. And even after all of that, it just wasn't going to happen. He wasn't going to survive. And that was just so hard to grapple with at that time. So I went home, spent a few days with him. His lung condition wasn't going very well. Then it improved to a point where they were like, all right, you can probably go back and take finals. So I come back here, still very uncertain of what was going on, get the finals done. I had all my teachers pack them in the one day so I could just bang them out and get out of here. And then I went back, semester over. Probably 2 days later, we went into the hospital room, And the doctor came in and was like, at this point, the cancer's back in full force. It's going to start spreading. We can hook him up to a life support and roll with that, but there's no real chance of him actually recovering. He'd just be in like a vegetable form. Or we can just let it run its course, treat him for pain, stuff like that, and he was going to pass away. So we're sitting there in the hospital room that, you know, we'd had good times in there. We spent Christmas in the hospital room. Things were going decently well throughout the halfway point of that year. And now at this point, to just sit there and face the fact that, you know, the doctor was just telling us head on he was going to die one way or another was just the worst thing in the world. Definitely the worst moment of my life ever. And we threw back and forth, what are we going to do? Ultimately, it was his decision. And I still can't believe it. He was always one of the strongest people I knew. But for him to be in that position, have the doctor come in front of your family to say, you're going to die one way or another, you got to pick which way it's going to be. And for him to go, we'll just run the course. Like, he just faced it stone face, no tears or anything. Like, I couldn't even imagine being in that position. And we sat there breaking down ourselves, and we were like, all right, we got to do what he wants. And the next few days, he was just trying to struggle for air. It was just a very visually displeasing thing. And his whole family came in, our whole family came in, my mom's two brothers came in, and they always had like a funny, like jokey relationship with my dad. And so they were like cracking jokes back and forth, but my dad was just sitting there, you know, so skinny, so weak of breath, like breathing like oxygen in, and they were like telling their classic jokes back and forth, and he was like trying to laugh, like you could see him struggling to laugh through like all the pain. And you know, the medicine was starting to set in, so he was just like slowly starting to fade away from us. And it was tough. My friends came in during those days and spent time with me just to keep my mind off things. We waited about 2 days as he grew weaker and weaker and the medicine set in more and more. And ultimately, we just had to face the fact that that was it at that point. So we had to make the best of the time. One thing I always wanted to do with him was have a beer. Like, I just always imagined us going to the bar one day, because he was a big beer guy in his day. You know, he had quit it in the last few years as his health came and go, but I always wanted to have a beer with him. So me and my aunt, you know, rolled to the liquor store. She ran in and grabbed a big pack of Sam Adams, and we rolled in and we, you know, whipped it out, and everyone's like obviously like all like bent out. They're like, oh, this guy is 19-year-old's about to have a beer in the hospital room, look out. And we sat there, had our beer, and there was a moment where I had to face him for the last time before he was gonna like consciously just fall out of it. And I was like, you know, did I make you proud? He was like, yeah. And I was like, do you have any advice for me going forward? And he just said, keep doing what you're doing and keep your nose to the grindstone. So as tough as that moment was, that whole week was, I got to have like some beautiful last moments with him that I'm never going to forget. And obviously it spurred a whole marathon fund now. Get some money to the hospital that helped him a lot, and hopefully will help some people actually survive the disease going forward. So the final night, May 9th, 2017, me and my sister went home from the hospital. My mom was staying there with him for the night. We made it all the way home. It's like a 25-minute ride from Boston to Peabody. We got to the front door, and I went to sit down in the back room, and my sister started freaking out. And this hit her very hard, this whole scenario and year and everything like that.
How old is your sister?
She's 2 years younger than me, so she's 17.
What's
going
her name?
On 18. Anne. So this hit her really hard, the whole year, the whole process. And my mom had called her right when we got home that night and said, things are happening, you got to get back in. So she came in the back and started freaking out, going crazy. I was just trying to keep a calm demeanor, because at that point, you know, we had our moment, we had to accept what was coming. And she's freaking out, going nuts, like just screaming and yelling. And she's like, let's go, let's go. And I'm just sitting there trying to like remain as calm as I can, because we had to drive back into Boston. So she was trying to hop in the car, drive away, and I went across the street to one of our neighbors. I was like, she's not driving, no way. So finally I got the wheel, drove in complete silence, playing like a little like light music going in, and we got all the way into Boston, went up to the hospital room, and when we walked in, my mom was sitting there, my dad had passed away about like 30 minutes before, so he was laying there, passed away, my sister was going crazy. I was just sitting there, again, not knowing how to react to something. Like, there's no handbook on how to react to like a family member dying, and there was my dad just sitting there dead next to me. And at that point, that was it. The battle was over. You know, I don't like to say we lost it, because we had a lot of great memories that last year. We had a lot of great time over the years. And my mom turned to me and she said, you know, it's just us three now. We got to get through it. He gave us so many great years. A lot of people don't have amazing fathers like we had. And at that point, that was reassuring for me. I got to have my last moments with him. You know, he fully supported everything I was doing and urged me to keep going. And we still had the rest of the family to keep each other going forward past that. So that's just a moment I'm never going to forget in my life. That whole week, that whole year, it tested me emotionally, physically, and everything else. And I'm here. I made it. I'm still here at school. I'm still alive. So it wasn't great. It tested me big time, and it stinks. I'm going to have to live the rest of my life without my father. Like, that night, I was just thinking, like, how am I going to grow up? How am I going to become a man without him? And she was like, you know, he already put you in position to do that.
What happened next?
So next, we had to do the funeral arrangements, all of that. We had to do the wake downtown in Peabody. We had to get all the friends and family members together and, you know, do all the things you do with a funeral. We had the wake, all my friends, you know, people came up from Syracuse. My best friends came from Syracuse, New York City, wherever they were staying at that time. They all came for the wake. So that was amazing having them there. Some of the, you know, people I work with, like Nick Gelso with CLNS, he came up from Pennsylvania to be there. It was just, you know, as terrible of a situation as it was, to have like all my friends and family members together in that space, receiving like a million texts from people I know. Like, I can be reserved at times, and, you know, like focusing on like my craft and all that nonsense. But like, for to just have that week where I could just spend time with my family members, remember the good times with my dad, you know, get together with friends who were supporting me. That wake was amazing. And, you know, like, I wasn't breaking down or anything at that point, because, you know, all that emotion was let out through the year. I made it through the year. I made it through that week before. And now this was just a time for us to get together and, you know, celebrate his life and all the good times we did have. Like, that message my mom gave me set in at that point. And at the funeral, I gave a speech about all our good times out on, you know, boats and vacations and everything else. Like, it just, I really wanted to celebrate the good times we did have and not, like, harp on the fact that, like, all right, there's going to be decades and decades ahead and I'm not going to be able to spend with them.
As you've talked about earlier, you know, that when you say breaking down was that physical expression of all the mental anguish you had. You live your life very publicly on Twitter, definitely connecting with people, and we've seen that in terms of the donations. And just, you know, you see people all the time interacting with you on Twitter.
Yeah.
How did you decide to deal with this, you know, so something so personal and something that affected you so greatly? How did you decide or plan, I guess, to handle this whole process when your identity is wrapped up a lot in how you're, you know, how public it is?
Yeah, it was, I didn't really know what to do after that. Like, I knew I had to make the best of it. I knew I had to do something meaningful, because that would just keep me motivated and give me a goal and something personal to grapple with while I was just going through, like, there wasn't a lot of angst in the weeks that followed. It was summer vacation. I was just staying at home. There was just, like, a lot of reflecting in what I was going to do now. And the night my dad died, we came home, and my cousin, Anthony Gill, on my mom's side, came over. And he's a good friend of mine. We don't spend a lot of time together. You know, there's, like, family feuding going on over there and all that junk. But we stay connected very well, texting, calling all the time, like keep an eye on each other. He goes to Stonehill College and plays football there. And, you know, we're very two different personalities. He's like a, you know, this big, tough football player type guy. And I'm like, you know, right here and, you know, self-reflective and all that junk and, you know, very heady and whatever. So we're two very different people. But we have like a closer relationship over the fact that, you know, we didn't see each other a lot growing up. We both faced challenges growing up. In that sense of me losing my dad, him having two parents that divorced. So the first thing he did was come over after my dad died that night, and we had a conversation, a very important conversation. Like, that really just helped me regain focus at that point and move forward past it. And one of the things he said to me was, you know, you used to run all the time. You'd been running over the summer just to stay in shape. Like, you should run the marathon or something. And like, he has thrown these like ideas at me before, like doing like a podcast, like covering sports when I used to talk sports all the time. And then he threw this at me. So it was another thing I was like, yeah, run the marathon, yeah. But then I was like, you know, that's what I'm looking for. Like, that's a goal I can grapple with over the next year or so while I'm trying to recover from this. And I think about a month later, 2 months later, we were having a party at my friend's house, and we were sitting down just reflecting on it for the first time. I'd kind of kept to myself in the month after he died. And so we were reflecting on it. I was, you know, it was really the first time I broke down since he died. And me and my friend Craig, my friend Serena, we were talking back and forth, and I was like, I had this idea to run the marathon. And they both pat me on the back, and they're like, all right, we're going to do it. Let's do it then. And from that day on, I set my mind to it, and it's been a journey ever since toward that point.
How are the logistics for signing up for the Boston Marathon? Obviously, a lot of runners qualify, and there's a time and everything, but how did you go about entering?
It was tough trying to latch on with an organization at first. I just started running on my own, trying to get my miles up personally and get my body in the physical shape to, you know, go toward the marathon a year and a half in advance. And I couldn't find an organization at first. Like, I thought about the Leukemia Society. I reached out to them. They never got back to me.
So the organizations, you can still run the marathon if you're affiliated with an organization.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I'll explain that. You have the competitive runners. You get the people who run 2 hours on TV, like waving the flags and stuff, breaking through the ribbon. But behind them, there's like waves and waves of charity runners. So the Boston Marathon, while being like one of the premier marathons athletically in the world, is also like one of the biggest fundraising opportunities in the world, because you just have tens of thousands of people with thousands of dollars in donations needed to run. So if you don't qualify time-wise, and the time's tough, I don't know it off the top of my head, it's just over 2 hours or just over 3 hours maybe, something really hard to accomplish. And now, even if you do accomplish it, so many people are trying to run the Boston Marathon that they're adding like a new cutoff. So people that reach the cutoff time are starting to like get rejected now. That's how popular the race is. But you also have a charity, bunch of charities, the Celtics, Leukemia, Heart Association, all these different associations have teams in the marathon. And I saw Leukemia Society had one, but I also saw Beth Israel, the hospital he was at for that whole year, had one.
So that's who you're running with?
Yep, that's who I'm running with. And I reached out to them, and we went back and forth. It was kind of frustrating at first because, you know, I had a story that resonated with them. And, you know, I told them how determined I was to run it, but they didn't really seem to take, like, my fundraising ideas seriously. I was like, you know, I got this big outreach on social media. I can use the site. I got a ton of friends. And they're like, yeah. So they made me put this plan together. They really, like, pushed me to get organized and have like a concrete idea if they were going to let me in and do it. And you know, that frustrated me. It pissed me off, actually. But I put it together, did it. I was like, all right, here's my plan. I like said these different events, different goals for each month. And finally they're like, all right, you're in. So
how much do you have to raise?
$7,500. And
where are you at now?
We're at 4,800 something. So we're already well on our way there. It'd be great to raise more. Obviously, this is all going to the Cancer Center at Beth Israel. I wanted it to go to leukemia research in particular, but there were only a number of different things you could have the money allocated to at Beth Israel and their plan. So Cancer Center sign. It goes to all the services that he was receiving there while he was getting treated there, and a number of other people are getting treated there as well, obviously. So it's going to their care, even though it's not going to the research.
This is a good spot to plug how you can donate to you.
Mm-hmm. So it's on my Twitter page. It's on my Instagram raise. It's a crowd rise. So, you know, I can't, like, say out the link or whatever, but at RealBobManning, BMan26 on Instagram, the link's up in both of those places, or you can search Beth Israel Marathon Team, and there's a CrowdRise page with all the runners' profiles up there. Mine's one of them. I wrote a little story, too, about the whole year and everything that led me to that point that's up there as well, if anyone wants to read it. But, I mean, even if you're throwing $5, $10, like, it means the world to me. And I've had friends donate, family donate. The fact that we're at 4,800 and it's only January is amazing to me. But
when's the deadline?
The end of April. So April 30th is the deadline to raise the 7,500. I think we're going to get more. Hopefully we will get more, maybe like upwards of 10,000. And
what do you do with the money?
It's going to the Cancer Center. So you donate it on that CrowdRise page. Goes directly to Beth Israel, and it's going to fund their cancer center and the services people provide there.
Right, and so when is the marathon?
April 16th, Marathon Monday, Patriots Day in Boston, big deal. It's going to be crazy. It's something I've always wanted to do, and for all the like bad moments I've had over the last year and a half, all the breakdowns and everything else, I can just imagine now running through the streets of Boston, getting closer and closer to the city, having everybody cheering on the sidelines. Like, that's going to be like my Super Bowl moment for like an athlete's perspective.
Right. How are you training?
It's interesting. So I started last summer just running, trying to get back into running shape. And then
You used to run?
Yeah, I used to be on the track team at my high school, but I was a sprinter. So I'd never done more than like 8 miles at a time in a day. So it was different getting into the distance thing, trying to get the miles up and stuff like that. It was just running. Once I got back here in the fall, I started to follow the Boston Marathon plan. At this point, I still wasn't on the team. So they have a training plan up on their site that I just started following every day. I'd run from like South Campus, way below campus, all the way to like the top of North End of campus and back, all these different routes all around the campus. There's a ton of hills here too, as you know, which like makes it wicked hard, but got me in decent shape to where I am now. And then my buddy Tyler called me and was like, oh, there's a half marathon in Peabody. So I was like, all right, there we go. That'll be like a stepping stone for me. So I did that Boston Marathon training all throughout the fall as like training for this half marathon in Peabody. And I did that over Thanksgiving break. And ever since then, it's just been following the Beth Israel plan they've given me. So every week it's, you know, 5-6 mile runs, 2 workouts a week, so like sprinting type stuff, like 800 meters, mile runs and repeats, stuff like that. And then on the weekend, you do like a longer, like 10, 11 mile run, and that's just going to keep building up toward April.
How'd the half marathon go?
The half marathon was great. It was freezing. It was like 36 degrees that day, which would be like nothing now where we're at in the 20s. That day was exciting. It was like a kind of like a test run for the marathon. It was all the way through the west end of Peabody. We went down this long bike path for 3 miles, through all the hills and neighborhoods out in west. It was really hard. It was, you know, 13 miles. I didn't run that far to that point. And it was, once you get to the 8 mile point, you start hitting this wall and you're like, oh my God. Like, especially in a race setting, I'd been running so much alone at that point. So now when you had people like running on either side of you, passing you, you're like, oh my God, where am I at? And you start speeding up. It's funny, there was this middle school teacher, Mr. Rapone, who was in the race too, and I was on the starting line with him. So I saw him pass me like 3-4 miles in. So I'm like, oh my God, this guy was way behind me at first. So we started like gunning it, racing through like the 3-7 mile mark. At least I was. I don't even know if he was thinking about me. Probably not. But that's what it felt like for me. And, you know, there's a different element to just running by yourself rather than, like, running in, like, a not race setting, but, like, in a crowd setting where people are passing you and just going at different rates.
At the end, did you feel like you could turn around and run the same thing all the way back?
That's really, because that was the first thing I thought of. I finally, we went around this baseball field, this old lady passed me, and I was like, oh my God, I can't come in behind the old lady. So I gunned it and went through the finish line. And I just put both hands on my knees. My legs just felt like they weren't there. My head started throbbing. Like, the cold started hitting me again. And, like, for the next 30, 45 minutes, I was just trying to, like, physically recover. And it was, like, a pain that I had never felt before, just a full-body exhaustion. And so I started, like, downing, like, Chick-fil-A's and, like, Gatorade.
They had Chick-fil-A at the finish
line. Yeah, they had a bunch of Chick-fil-A sandwiches lined up. I guess protein and a bunch of fat, too.
Did they tell you that was at the end before?
No, I didn't. And so that was very nice. And then I was standing there just, like, trying to get whatever into my body I could. And they're like, now the 18, 19 winners. So I was probably, like, one of two 19, 18-year-olds in the race, but I technically won that grade level. So they called me up and were like, congratulations. And they gave me $10 to Fuddruckers, which is one of my favorite hamburger places. So they knew their winner well.
So for you, what are you listening to, or what do you plan on listening to during the marathon?
I'm definitely going to be listening to music. I listen to music the whole half marathon. Some people are like, how do you run with headphones the whole time? I can't run without music. Like, I just need
it. Like, what sort of music?
So the half marathon, I listen to Big Sean's I Decided. Like, just pump up songs like that, like self-reflective songs like that. You know, you have Bounce Back on there that gets you pumped up. There's a song at the end that's like, all I want to do is make my city proud. So stuff like that, just to get me fired up through it. My favorite artist, I'm always going to have, like, just music I like on. Like, I'm not like a pump up music type guy. I just want to hear music I like. So that was something I played. Vic Mensa I played during the half marathon. What am I going to play during the full marathon? There's going to be a lot of time, which is like...
do you have a time goal?
3:45, actually. 3 hours, 45 minutes is what I'm aiming for, which is like 8-minute pace-ish, 8:30-ish in that range.
And so, what'd you do the half at?
Like 8:45-ish, so I came in a little behind. But I also like did that stupid racing with the teacher in the middle that like... And I came out like 7:30 pace. So that was good because I made a bunch of mistakes in that half marathon that I'm definitely not going to make in the full marathon now.
Are you planning on the adrenaline carrying you through a little bit?
Yeah, absolutely. Especially the fact that training only gets you up to 20 miles or so. So there's like an extra 6 that like I've never run before in my life that I'm going to have to make up at the end of it. So, like, I felt that feeling in the half. Even at the end, like, you like, can you turn around and do another 13? That day, like, no way. So, like, there's going to be, like, a 5-6 miles at the end that I'm just physically not going to be able to do. But the fact that it's Boston, the fact that, like, this has extra meaning to me, of course, and then, like, there'll be people cheering on the sidelines all the way through in the Boston. And then, you know, seeing all the, like, buildings just get closer and closer, I'm counting on that big time to give me the push toward that finish line.
What are your expectations for this? Obviously, this has been when you take a really big emotional moment and you kind of put this toward, you know, a physical event. What do you kind of expect from this event? Have you put a lot into it in the sense that this has become really symbolic for you? Or are you just thinking about, you know, I'm doing this for the simple purpose and we're going to go do it?
Yeah, I'm going to make something bigger mentally out of, like, almost everything I do. Like, that's just, like, I'm a deep thinker. Like, everything I do is going to be, like, a mission. Like, every day is, like, a mission. Like, I'm making bigger things in life out of, like, little things than they really are, which helps me a lot because, like, I don't have, like, many mundane days, especially now with this marathon training. Like, every day I'm going into a day, like, all right, like, I'm doing a workout and this is like going to directly link to this marathon day that I'm anticipating so much. And yeah, I am expecting that to be like a really emotional, like huge day. That's really the only way I can describe it. Like, we're going to ride out miles west of Boston in the bus. We're going to get out and wait for the waves to set off. Like, I'm imagining it already. And that final stretch running into Boston, seeing Fenway as you go by that area, seeing all the buildings line up, like, it's going to be special. And like I talked about earlier with the wake and all my family and friends being there, it's going to be almost a year to the day that he passed away, April 16th, May 9th. It's going to be a good opportunity for everybody to get back together and have a reason to remember him that day, because... You know, over the months and months and months, it's been months since, you know, we all get back to our lives, but you do have to have those moments where you keep his memory alive. So that's going to be that extra special meaning of that day.
So your whole family's coming to watch?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm counting on almost everybody being there. All of them have donated for the most part. Hopefully some friends, you know, that's during the spring semester here, but hopefully all my friends can get on a bus and come back and see it and, you know, take a long weekend and skip those Monday classes here because they don't give us holidays here like they do back in Boston. But it's going to be special. Like, I feel like I almost deserve this moment with, like, how hard I've been working toward it, all the crap I had to go through last year. It's really going to be rejuvenating for me and be like, you know, winning a championship on the sports field. It's going to have that feeling no matter what if I cross the finish line.
When you cross the finish line, how do you expect that you'll feel?
I'm going to be going crazy. I don't think physically I'm going to be able to go too crazy, but like I'm already imagining myself like bumping my chest and like waving my arms and just going wild and, you know, pointing up to the sky and everything else. Like, I'm gonna celebrate. After 26 miles, you gotta celebrate. We're gonna have a party that night for sure. And then, you know, I'm gonna go over and see all the family that's waiting there. Like, this is gonna probably be really special for my mom too, from an emotional standpoint. My sister, for that matter, too. Who have, you know, my sister did a good fundraiser with her volleyball team to raise money for leukemia research. So she had her moment this year too, and that, you know, this is gonna be my moment. From, you know, they said that night, this from now on, the day my dad died, the three of us, it was just gonna be us sticking together going forward. Well, my sister had her fundraiser, I had my fundraiser, and you know, my mom's kept working as a single parent now. So.
And what does your mom do?
She's a nurse manager at Beverly Hospital in the Boston area, so she's in the healthcare field too. Big credit to her. That year was, you know, as tough as that was for me, I was just out here at college doing college stuff, and she had to go to work every day. She had about a month that the insurance company gave her off for like emotional reasons, but then after that, you know, they made her go back to work. So for a long time over that year, she was working, taking care of Anne during the day and all the stuff she had to do, still in high school at that point, and then spending nights going into the hospital and spending time with my dad. So she was like working 24 hours around the clock during that time to keep the family going. So she deserves more credit than anybody through all of this.
Bobby, I appreciate you taking the time to sit down and do this. I think I speak for the listeners too. Is there anything else you feel like we didn't talk about, you feel like a listener should know?
You know, take time, take energy to donate whatever you can to a good cause. Like, you never know when a good cause that people are trying to promote and work toward is going to touch you personally. So even if just one day you want to toss $5 toward, I don't know, like the Salvation Army or something, or the Hurricane Relief Fund or anything like that, like $5 in the long run is nothing compared to how much it's going to help people, like in my position, when it hits them. And, you know, if everybody in their heart just gave a little bit, it'd add up to so much and make such a big difference, because we really feasibly live in a world where we could accomplish getting rid of something like AML, where it never has to affect a family like it affected mine again. And, you know, all it takes is just picking a cause one day and just giving a little something toward it. It doesn't even have to be that much. So that's just a reflective thing I've taken from this. And, you know, hopefully whoever listens can take that away too.
Thank you for your time, Bobby.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate you, man.